everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. It has been a while since January since we've done a podcast, and I will explain in the post-show where I've been for the last few months. But today, I'm interviewing Jennifer Swankowski, who has her master's in social work from the University of Houston, a postgraduate fellowship in end-of-life care, and a PhD in clinical social work from Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. She has worked as a family therapist at Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and was an adjunct professor at Boston College. She then returned to Houston, Texas, where she served as an individual and family therapist at the Menninger Clinic, was an instructor for individuals conducting their postgraduate fellowships at Menninger, and was also an adjunct professor at the University of Houston. For the last 10 years, Jennifer has been in private practice working with adults providing individual and couples counseling. In her practice, she focused mainly on professionals dealing with issues such as anxiety, addiction, and relationship struggles, as well as young adults who were failing to launch in their lives. Unfortunately, due to a neurotoxic reaction to an antibiotic and subsequent struggle to come off the benzodiazepines prescribed for that injury, Jennifer stepped away from her clinical practice in 2020. During this time away, she has focused on healing as well as heavily researching medication injury and benzodiazepine withdrawal. She has written a book called The Waiting Room, My Journey of Recovery from Medication Injury and Benzodiazepine Withdrawal, that will be out in early July of this summer. She is currently working on a second book and creating YouTube videos on her channel, Jennifer Swan, PhD, where she discusses various issues related to benzodiazepine withdrawal, as well as a separate series called Therapy from the Sidelines, where she discusses a wide array of psychological topics. She is passionate about being a part of advocacy and awareness efforts and serves as a member of the Medical Advisory Board for the Benzodiazepine Information Coalition. I hope you enjoy this interview. It has a lot of really important information, and please stay tuned after the podcast for our post-show discussion. Thank you. During the years that I've been involved in benzodiazepine withdrawal, I hate to see anyone end up in these groups sick and suffering. But from your suffering, a lot of good is coming out of it with your YouTube channel and your book, In the Waiting Room, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. So welcome, Jen.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. So we've been in touch during your journey of withdrawal. So yeah. If you can start with how your iatrogenic illness started and your method of tapering and what happened when you took supplements, because I want people to understand that you truly have suffered. We want people to understand just how difficult coming off prescription drugs can be.
Sure. So, my journey actually began in 2016, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time there, but it's important to note kind of the entry point in. So in September of 2016, I ended up taking an antibiotic called Levaquin, and I had what turned out to be, took many months for people to be able to figure this out with me, but it was a neurotoxic injury to my central nervous system. Of course, nobody had heard of this. People didn't know what to do. My doctors didn't know what to do about it. So they said, well, we're going to stick you on Xanax. Your nervous system is clearly lit up like a Christmas tree, and we're going to put you on some Xanax. And they did. And I don't know that that actually did much for me. I mean, over the course of time I healed, I don't know if the benzo at that point had anything to do with my recovery from the Levaquin injury. And Geraldine, I had kind of an interesting experience where about a year on the benzo, I walked off. I literally stopped taking it. And I did not really have too much in the way of withdrawal, anything that I would have considered to be withdrawal at that point. That proved to be disastrous because then about 2.5 years later, so late December of 2019, I went in for a routine surgery. I had polyps in my uterus. It was going to be a 45-minute surgery. Went in for the surgery, came out, and you have to know at this point I was on no medication. I had no psych history. I was living my life, traveling, working as a clinician, friending, family, all of that. Come out of the surgery and felt very wired, felt very off, and began to have some kind of strange symptoms again. Again, nervous system issues. I went back and I said, hey, what was in this anesthesia cocktail that you gave me? Well, just Versed, which at that point I didn't know was a benzodiazepine. And of course, at this point, I wasn't making any connections to, I'd been on Xanax, come off Xanax, now I'm given Versed. But I come out of surgery and they're like, well, you know, just start taking some Xanax again and some gabapentin and, you know, see how you do with it. And it'll help again. Well, it did the opposite. Unfortunately, I started taking these medications and I started very slowly because I didn't want to be on anything. But the more that I began to take this Xanax, I was taking alprazolam, the generic of Xanax, I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. My temperature was getting dysregulated. My tinnitus was off the charts. I was blurry vision, shaking, insomnia, panic, depersonalized, derealized. And it was kind of coming and going. I was still able to work, but I was literally running home from work and just staring at walls for hours. And over the course of a couple months, they just, you know, the idea was, well, you clearly need more. There was not the understanding that this medication could be actually creating a problem for me. And I wasn't clued into that either. So I continued to kind of slowly increase. I was taking it kind of as needed. And they're like, no, you need to take it regularly around the clock. So I began doing that. And I just went from bad to worse. So this is now March of 2020. And I'm like, look, guys, this stuff is making me sick. I need to come off. And of course the way that we tend to be tapered off is 25% drop, you know, another 25% drop. Well, I tried 25% drop and Geraldine, like the bottom came out of my life. And what I mean by that is I literally would stand in my kitchen staring at a sweet potato, trying to figure out how to make it. I was afraid of my shower. I couldn't sleep. I was shaking. I ended up having to basically close down my private practice at that point, which was very traumatic. You know, I'd spent years building this practice, but I was in no shape mentally or physically to be seeing anybody. And this began my understanding of what was happening. It was when I found Benzo Buddies. I found you a couple months later. I started putting the pieces together. And I went through a couple different doctors who were like, no, there's no way that benzos are causing this. There's no way that dropping at 25% or 30% would create this situation. And I was instructed to updose more. So I listened. And so now it's April of 2020 and I get up to 1.5 milligrams of Xanax and I'm coming out of my skin. I'm not able to work. I'm not able to live alone. I have to move in with my parents, because I was afraid to be alone. I was afraid to drive. I was afraid. I mean, this all happened so fast, to go from completely functional to non-functional. And I finally found a psychiatrist. It took a long time, which was weird because, you know, I'm a clinician in Houston, and so I know a lot of psychiatrists. But, you know, the party line was, look, you look really, really anxious and you look really out of control. You need more. And I knew better. At this point, I was clicking into the idea of I don't need more and I'm not going any higher than 1.5. I'm not going to keep going up. At one point, I was actually told by one psychiatrist, if you have to take 6 milligrams of Xanax to feel better, who cares? You're a mess. And I did not stay with that psychiatrist. And I located one who did not really know how to taper me, but she was at least not going to rip me off the med. She was going to let me taper at my own speed, and she was willing to let me learn online and from other people how to do it. And that was kind of the best thing we could do. At the same time, this is now May of 2020. She also starts me on some supplementation, and I was actually on high doses of supplements. I don't know if I can say the name on here. Am I allowed to say the company name or should I just not?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you were on. Yeah. And normally we know that's a good company, but they put you on high doses.
Yeah, so there was a company out of Canada called Hardy Nutritionals, and I do think they are a good company, and I do think they probably do good work. I think, unfortunately, with iatrogenic injuries, I don't think anybody is well-versed in that, so I don't think they are either, no fault of their own. But unfortunately, you know, my doctor thought, well, this will help. We'll get you really boosted up. And so I started taking 10 vitamins a day and 6 amino acids. So I was taking 16 pills a day. on top of my Xanax that I was now at 1.5. And they also, before I knew better, started me on mirtazapine, which is an antidepressant at a low dose to help with sleep and appetite, because I'd lost, you know, like 28 pounds in 21 days. It was like a crazy amount of weight loss. I wasn't sleeping. So now it's the end of May 2020. I'm on these 16 supplements. I'm on mirtazapine, and I'm on this very high dose for me of Xanax, which was 1.5 milligrams a day. And eventually over the next, you know, month or two, I stabilized. Now, whether that was the result of a higher dose of Xanax, the supplement, I have no idea, but I stabilized. And when I say stabilize, I don't mean I could go back to work full time or anything like that. I just mean I wasn't staring at walls, crying, pacing, unable to calm myself, dysregulated, you know, my temperature out of control. Things calmed down enough to where I could kind of function on a basic level. And what was weird about my process, and it's still intact, is that what has not been affected for me has been my cognition. I've always been able to think. Now, there were the early days where I couldn't, I'd stare at a potato and not know how to make it. But my cognition in terms of being able to research and write during my better hours stayed intact. So that's always been a blessing, but also confusing for people, because on one hand, it looks like I'm doing better than I am. But now it's the end of May. I'm just kind of, you know, starting on this huge supplementation, and I wait a couple months and I'm stable enough to where I want to start to taper. And again, stable enough, meaning functional enough. My mornings were still terrible. I went off to Pennsylvania to live at my parents' lake house with them for 6 months. It was COVID. So the whole world was kind of shut down anyway. So from June until October of 2020, I lived up at their lake house with them and, you know, exercised and walked and began my taper and did okay. I was tapering about between 7 and 10% a month. I could not go more than that without getting really disabled. But I was able to exercise, read, enjoy their company during this time, work a little bit on different projects, but certainly not myself, maybe operating at 50 or 60%. And we get to basically around January of 2021. So now I've been tapering about, I don't know, at that point, 8 months, something like that. And I go in for a checkup and my doctor is like, oh my God, your B6 is nearing a toxic range, which is odd because B6, the B vitamins, we tend to pee them out. They're not fat soluble. But for whatever reason, after several blood draws, mine were showing nearing a toxic range. And so spoke to her and my psychiatrist, and they said, you know, come off the vitamins. I guess you don't need them anymore. And I said, well, do I just come off of them? And they said, yeah, you know, they're just vitamins. I was like, okay. But I kind of knew better. I kind of knew that my nervous system was like toothpicks and bubble gum. I didn't think I could just come off 16 pills. But I didn't know how to come off. And I consulted with lots of people and everyone was like, I don't know, they're just vitamins and aminos. You should be able to come off. And so I called the company actually and asked them, and they said, you know, if you have to come off, you need to taper over the course of a couple of weeks, maybe, you know. So I ended up taking 3 months to taper myself off these 16 supplements. And basically I fell apart. So this, my tapering of those supplements began in, let's say, February or early March of 2021. I was fully off them by last June. And by last June, I was in a complete acute withdrawal. And what I mean by that is I just lived in chemical terror, afraid to leave my apartment, afraid to drive again, unable to socialize with family or friends, would wake up in panic, very bad intrusive thoughts. My mental symptoms have been the worst in all of this. Terrible intrusive thoughts, violent images, intrusive memories of things that really weren't even true. It was as if my brain was like pulling up anything and everything and just like spinning like a Stephen King novel. You know, just everything would distort. I again lost 30.
I remember how hard that was.
Yeah,
yeah, it was very difficult.
Yeah, I called you many times because I had never experienced any psychiatric issue before, and then to suddenly have this onslaught of just terrifying images, terrifying thoughts, intrusive, repetitive looping. You know, for all practical purposes, a really, severe kind of OCD-like picture, and severe anxiety picture. And, again, for somebody who's never had a psych history, who now still meet criteria, for 5 or 6 DSM-5 diagnoses, it was hell. And so probably from June, so I came off the supplements, and, that was a disaster, and I can explain why. I think it's important for people to hear this as they think about supplementation. And this isn't to say don't or do; it's just to say what my experience was. But basically, from June until November, Thanksgiving was the first time I was able to go and be around my family and stay longer than 20 minutes. And I actually was able to stay for most of the day, and actually, enjoy most of the day. But between June and November, the end of November, I was very, very disabled. We actually had to, my parents were away again at their summer home. So we had to hire a caregiver. I had to hire somebody to be with me during the day. Not because I wanted a lot of reassurance. I would actually call you for that, or a couple of other people. I just wanted somebody in the next room. And the other thing is, I would forget to eat. Like, if I didn't have somebody bring me food, I could go probably a week without drinking water or eating and not realize that I was doing that. I was, even though cognitively I was intact, there was some weird disconnect for me with hydration and nutrition. And I was really couldn't be alone, because I wouldn't think to feed myself. It was a very strange time. I dealt with suicidality. And what I mean by that for me was not that I wanted to not be here or to die, but it was this sense of it was inevitable. It was a feeling of this is going to happen. It's happening. There's no way out of this. It was the strangest feeling. It's a horrible feeling. Again, June through November, I was really acute. And slowly in November up until now, I've been healing and coming out of that. One thing that did happen during that 6 or 7 month period is on one of the days that I was not in my right mind and I did not have somebody with me, I got in my car and drove and got lost a couple miles from my home. And somebody called my brother, and my brother came to get me. And I was just very disoriented and really hopeless, and could not believe my life had fallen apart to the extent that it had. And at that point, we ended up having to do something. And I knew that I was either going to be forced to go inpatient someplace, or I was going to have to do something. And really what I wish I would have done is just hold tight. At that point, I was down to 0.65 of my Xanax. And I wish I would have just, kind of let the months ride. But unfortunately, the decision was made to updose me to 1 milligram of Xanax. So I updosed. It did not help, or it certainly didn't help right away. That I updosed in August, and I was probably in my worst state in August and September. So the updose itself did nothing, certainly in the immediate sense of things. And I just kind of had to bed surf and get through the day. I also had I think people sometimes refer to it as an internal akathisia, but I think Chris Page has a better word for it. He calls it agitated dysphoria. And that's really what I had. I didn't have to pace, but I would literally sit on my bed frozen and shake and feel like I was going to give birth to the Incredible Hulk. It was something I would not wish on, none of this would I wish on my least favorite person. It was just hell. So now it's June, And when I updosed in August, I updosed a milligram. I held my taper for almost 6 months. I held my taper until the middle of January. And I felt like I was kind of strong enough, even though still very disabled, but strong enough to start a slow taper. And I have done so. And when I say a slow taper, Geraldine, I taper 3% a month. If I go more than 3 to 3.5% a month, I start to lose it again. And I'm not willing to go back to that place. So to whatever control I have, which is not much, I'm willing to do a very slow taper to stay as functional as I am right now. And where I'm at right now is I'm down to 0.88 of my Xanax. I'm on no supplements other than a probiotic. I'm still on the mirtazapine. I can't touch that till I'm done. And I still have intrusive thoughts. I still have a lot of internal agitation. I'm not able to tolerate a lot of stress. I'm not able to tolerate the heat, which sucks living in Houston, Texas. It's 100 degrees already, so that's not fun. Yeah. But I'm able to laugh. You can hear me. I'm able to laugh again. I'm able to write. I'm able to be an advocate and research. I'm able to do enough. I'm not able to go back to being a therapist. I have lovely clients that I'm still in touch with that, you know, wonder when I'm going to come back. And I've said, you know, I think that's going to be a long way down the road because, you know, as you know, this is such an up and down process. And I can have a really good couple of hours followed by a couple of hours where I just need to lay still and do nothing and kind of stare or just try to kind of get through the time. So I'm back to where I'm able to do advocacy and awareness and write in my good hours and do this. I am able to enjoy my family again. I have not really ventured out with friends. I've just not really felt consistently well enough to do a lot of that, but I have been able to be back in my family, being around my nieces and nephews and being functional and probably well enough to where I can fake it, especially with the little ones in my family. They don't see me as sick. They did not see me for many, many months last summer. I would not let them see me. So that's where things are at right now.
So I like that you have had full control of your taper the whole time, because if somebody, let's say you went to a doctor and they controlled your taper, it would have been a nightmare. And that's something that we try to stress with people. It has to be in the hands of the person. And so some people feel they have to be on a set schedule. And right now, after all you've been through, you have your 3%. And if I had to do it all over again, I've always said I wouldn't do more than 3% also. So I think you're right there. But when you are going to say, do your cuts, is there something that you're waiting for? Like, again, there's no set schedule. Do you try to go every month? Are you going by your symptoms? And what are you looking for when you make that decision to do that 3% cut?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So just to say something about my taper in general, I'm doing a water taper. And it, so I do a daily micro taper. So there's I remove a little bit each day. And I do the calculations to where I'm staying in that 3 to 3.3% range. I became a mathematician and a chemist in this, I think, as most of us do. I had no desire to be those things, but I am one now. I have to say
the water titration, I've seen people that tried four times to get off. And then when they do water titration, they're very successful. So I never had to do it. I didn't have to learn it because I know it seems complicated. So let me ask you this. Once you understood it, is it easy for you now?
Very. Yeah. What I would tell people is that don't be afraid of it. I think what I see a lot of times with people thinking about doing a water titration is a couple things. One is it looks like the math is really hard. It does take a little bit of time to get used to, but once you know how to do it, you know how to do it. And even on my worst moments where I'm not, you know, really with it, I can do that math. And so don't be afraid of that, I would tell people. The other thing is that when you transition over to water, so when I was taking pills and I decided I wanted to water taper, you know, I didn't feel well for 2 or 3 weeks once I transitioned over, and it's a different delivery system. Okay. So that's important for people to know too, is not to get scared by the fact that those first couple weeks you might feel a little different. It does take a while to kind of settle into it. It took me about 2.5 weeks before I thought, okay, I've made the transition from pill to water. Now I can slowly start the taper. In terms of how I decide what I do now, I'm always symptomatic. So I have to, you know, how I gauge things is a little different than how I did at the beginning of my taper. Because I'm more symptomatic now as a result of what happened last summer. I just think that, you know, that really rung my bell. And so I'm more sensitized. My nervous system is just more sensitized. So what I do now is, since I do have control over it, thank God, my doctor has given me full control over it, which is about the best we can hope for at this point, right? As a doctor that allows us that right and privilege. And right. It is our right to do that, I think. But since I do a daily micro taper, and I'm also tapering Xanax, so different than like Valium that stays in your system for so long, where you might not feel a cut or a difference for a couple of days, with Xanax you feel it pretty quickly. So I get my data pretty quickly. And so like, for example, today, I know I have to go in this weekend and going to help my little brother with his kids. They're little kids. It's going to be hot out, and I'm holding for a couple of days. And that's what I'm just have resigned myself to do, which is I have thrown away my calendar. I no longer have an end date of when I will be off Xanax. That's not how I started my taper. I started my taper very much having an end date. I don't have an end date any longer. If it takes me, however long it takes me, it takes me. And so if the symptoms become too great, I usually hold a couple days, but I'm still never going more than 3.5%, even if I'm doing well. And I'm not willing to do it because I've tried it a couple times and it just doesn't work. So I'm not willing to feel that way any longer because I'm in perimenopause, which is a whole nother beast. If I'm hitting a hormonal part of my cycle where it's just, you know, it's just intersecting with the withdrawal in a way that's just too much, I might hold a day or two there. So I'm staying at, like I said, about 3.5%, but I will hold if I have to. And I've just thrown out the calendar.
Good. I think that's the best advice you can give. So what is your diet like while you're tapering? I want people to kind of understand what you're doing for you.
Yeah, so that was something that actually you helped me with and some other people helped me with pretty early on. When I realized what I was doing, when I realized what was happening to me, and you know, probably my story is not so different than many others, which is I was the one that kind of figured out what was happening to me, right? Like I didn't have doctors saying, oh, you've been injured, you know, by a benzo, or, oh, you're in withdrawal. No, it didn't happen that way. And so once I kind of figured it out with the help of you and many other people, I knew that I had to do whatever I could do. There's not much we can do to feel better in this, but there's a few things. And I think diet's one of them. So I, of course, do not eat anything with any added sugar. The only sugar I get is through fruit. I'm actually gluten-free for no other reason other than I thought, my gosh, I'm making all these other changes. Why not add that in? Who knows? So I'm gluten-free. Yeah. I drink no caffeine. I eat very low histamine because I'm aware of what this can do to that system as well. So I pay attention to the, you know, I don't eat things that are high in histamine. I try not to eat a lot of leftovers. There's certain foods that people can look up if they want to look up for a low histamine diet. So I try to stay in those categories. I found a farm nearby. I get farm raised chicken that's flash frozen right as soon as, right there on the farm. And I have it delivered to me. And actually there's a couple companies that people can do that if you don't live near a farm. And I found, I get my meat, from a company that, again, flash frozen right on the ship out of Alaska. So I try to, when I eat my salmon or my cod, it's coming from a company that's flash frozen. So I'm very conscientious about basically eating, meats, fruits, and veggies. I do eat some grains. I eat things like black rice and quinoa because they're high in magnesium. But no sugar, no artificial sugar, no sweeteners, no caffeine, no gluten, no dairy. And it sounds kind of awful, I'm sure, when people hear that, And it was for me because, you know, I loved food. It was my favorite thing to do was to go out on the weekends and, you know, have a beer or have a glass of wine and eat. But after a while, I've learned to kind of eat to survive. I don't eat as a form of avoidance or entertainment any longer. I eat to live. And so I think my diet has really helped. I make a smoothie every morning that I'll just tell you really quick what's in it. It's Swiss chard, celery, parsley, basil, coconut water, ginger tea that I make homemade, apples and wild blueberries. And I drink that smoothie every morning to get kind of a good boost of vitamins and fruit. And my diet's very clean.
Good. That sounds delicious. Delicious smoothie. So I'm going to ask you this. In all your years when you had your practice, do you think looking back that you had patients that might have been on psych meds that were affecting them?
Oh my God, Geraldine.
So, I don't even know if you can answer that.
No, I can absolutely answer it. I mean, because the reality is, I mean, in the book that I wrote, we'll talk about it. I talk about this and I'm writing a second book and it's in the second book too. I mean, part of my struggle right now is some grief and some professional identity crisis that I'm going through because, you know, I've been in the field for 26 years now and over 12 of those years were in some kind of higher end psychiatric hospitals, as well as, you know, many, many years in private practice. And while we would take a med history, you know, which is commonplace, right? Whether you're in private practice or you go into a psych hospital, they take a med history. Well, the problem is, so what? I mean, we would take this med history, but what was never being asked, the dots that never connected were, you know, are the meds these people on potentially causing the problem, and or have they recently come off a benzodiazepine, or have they come off in the last year? And if so, did things get worse? We never went any further. I never went any further. And so part of my problem, one of my grief issues right now that I go through is this, and I've really had to forgive myself, is that I was swimming in the Kool-Aid along with everybody else and not asking the right questions. And honestly, Geraldine, you know, I consider myself a pretty empathic, compassionate clinician. I don't think that it's only in having gone through it myself that I can now believe the extent of the damage that can be incurred. I don't think
it truly is unless you go through it.
I've sat here for hours contemplating, I would have believed them. It's not that I wouldn't have believed them, but I wouldn't have been able to understand them. Okay. And second of all, I would have been thinking, well, then we've got to find a medication to make it better. I was in the Kool-Aid of, if somebody's sitting in front of me with this litany of physical and mental and emotional distress and problems, what do we need to give you to fix this? What do we need to do to help you with this? And So there's a lot of looking back over the course of my career now and thinking, God, you know, this scares me. And I work with a wonderful therapist that knew me well before this. I believe every therapist should be in therapy. And thank God she knew me before, right? Because she knew me to be high functioning and fine. And then she saw my utter collapse in months. And she has now said the same thing. She's like, my God, I'm looking back over the last decades of my career and I'm having to reflect on how many people were maybe struggling with something like this that we just weren't noticing and calling it what it was.
Right. And when you found out what was wrong with you, you were in touch with a lot of medical professionals telling them about what happened to you. You know, they didn't really believe it. What do you think the resistance is? Does everybody have to feel it to understand it? And then we're going to get into the book because I really believe it should be in every medical school. They have to read your book. But what do you think the resistance is? As you told them, they knew you before and now you're telling them what happened afterwards. What do you think the problem is?
Well, I think the problem is partly what I was just saying, which is that I think a couple things. I think one is, you know, our culture, right? Number one, our culture is one that we are not supposed to be in distress. We're not supposed to be uncomfortable, right? So we live in a place of, you know, oh, you have a headache, there's a pill for that. You have, you know, perimenopause, there's a pill for that. You have PMS, there's a pill for that. You have the, so part of it is kind of the culture. I think the other piece of it is when I said swimming in the Kool-Aid, that's exactly what I mean. And because it's a different than drinking the Kool-Aid. Right. Drinking the Kool-Aid means, you know, I feel like maybe I'm a part of something. Swimming in the Kool-Aid means I don't even understand or could grasp that this is really an issue, because the medical establishment, the research that comes out, I mean, this goes so deep in terms of, you know, we can look back over the last, 60 years with benzodiazepines, you know, and we can see the problems. And none of this is new. You've been at this for decades yourself. But mm-hmm. the changes are not happening in the medical schools or, you know, in mainstream establishment. And so there is this, I think part of the problem is this. This is, I've tried to think about this, Geraldine, to be like, what the hell is the problem? Excuse my language. And I think part of what it is that it is a psych med. Okay. At the end of the day, whether you're put on it for, you know, my reason or panic or insomnia, whatever you're put on, it is a psych med. And when you say this psych med is making me feel crazy, the answer is going to be you need more psych med. I think that's part of the issue. Number one is that it's easy to be written off because we're arguing against what is in essence a psych med. I think the other issue, and I don't think it's malintention. I really don't, because I think that, again, I think it's swimming in the Kool-Aid. I think the doctors, you know, in my practice, for example, I worked with many doctors as clients, and they were coming to me in part because they were having to see, you know, 40, 50, 60 patients a day in their medical groups or in their hospitals just to be able to make their quota. Well, so there, you know, where's the time for them to look at the research? Number one, is the research even being, you know, is it ghost written? Who's funding the research? You know, what are the studies showing? So, I mean, I think there's so many different layers to this. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, certainly malintent. I really do think that for most of at least the people that I was engaged with, they were dumbstruck by it, but it seemed easier for them to say, oh, we think maybe you have, you know, fallen caregiver syndrome or burnout or a food allergy. It seemed easier for them.
Like they have to put a label.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I meet criteria right now. If I walked into a hospital tomorrow, I would, on a bad day, Geraldine, I would meet criteria for 5 or 6 DSM-5 diagnoses. Now, I taught that DSM-5, you know, on the graduate level, and I bought into that DSM-5. And that's why I'm saying, like, I'm now having to do this, you know, this professional review. And so, you know, what I hope to happen is, you know, we don't want to alienate the doctors. We need the doctors. And I think there's plenty of them out there. And some of them you've had on your podcast, and we've certainly talked about. There's people out there that are recognizing this is happening. And I think this is going to, my hope is that it's going to happen more and more, but I think we have to have a discourse that involves the doctors, right? Because the other piece that's happening is that, you know, up to 90%, I think that was the latest stat, of prescriptions for benzodiazepines are being written by primary care docs. So those are your family docs, your internists, your GPs, and sometimes your OBGYNs. But what happens is, as a result of what you go through, either being on the drug into tolerance, withdrawal, or withdrawal, is that you find yourself on psych wards, in psych hospitals, in ERs, and suddenly then you're being treated for all of these other things that are happening as a result of this medication or the discontinuation of it. So, long way of saying, what do I think of the resistance is? I think there's just the way the medical establishment is set up. It is not conducive to the doctors getting the right information in the right places. Where they're getting the information are from basically laymen or people saying, hey, this hurt me. And of course, it's the people that are saying, hey, this psych med hurt me, right? Really easy to be written off.
Right. Well, now I think with your book, you know, here we go. Your book is phenomenal. I was lucky enough to get to read it, which is, I think, is a must read for anyone on meds or even any medical professional, social workers, psychologists, psychotherapists. It should be standard in schools, seriously. And it's written very honestly. And you have such a great humor that even as you're suffering, I think somebody's going to laugh. You have to, if you don't find a little joy and laughter as you're going through the suffering, I think it helps. It breaks us a little more. So what are some, let's talk about the book. So what are some of the best methods, distractions, or, I mean, just the book in general, let's talk about it. Because then the YouTube channel, which again is great. Your humor is great. I love some of the phrases that you've coined. And I also liked when you talked about the benzo OCD, because I had a lot of strange OCD things that happened that, you know, they came, had them while I was sick, and they're gone. They just went away on their own. So if you want to talk about the book first and then the YouTube channel, you've, because of your injury, you've turned around and done so much to help those behind, that these are some of the things that we're going to have to help turn the medical profession around, I hope.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I mean, I owe a large part of that to you, Geraldine, because I think, you know, you were, somebody introduced me to you early on, and, you know, your availability to me and helping me understand, you know, what this was. And then also watching what you did, because, you know, I was kind of inspired by the fact that, you know, your own advocacy and, as you know, the new movie As Prescribed that just came out that documents some of what you've done. So you were a huge inspiration in my being able to say, okay, I can't work as a clinician. I could sit here for the next 5 years and stare at these walls. Or if I have an hour or two a day where I feel okay, maybe I can do something like Geraldine did. And that's actually what inspired me to write the book and to do the YouTube channel. And so
well, let me just say, I think it's good to have something to concentrate on, because when I was sick, if I didn't have something to concentrate to, all I would do was concentrate on my symptoms. That's all I would think about. So for me, that's where the advocacy came. I didn't want to see it happen to anyone else. And I, you know, in the intro, we do mention the book, but just tell us the name of the book. And I know we're here now in June 9th. And when is it coming out?
Sure. It should actually be out by the end of the month, July 1st at the latest. And the book is called The Waiting Room, which is my journey recovery from medication injury and benzodiazepine withdrawal. And it's kind of,
I hope it flies off the shelves.
I hope so. Well, yeah, I hope so too, for the sake of, you know, helping people if it will and can. But it was born out of exactly what you just said, which is, I've got to be able to do something with this. I can't just let this break me, because there was, you know, a period there where that's what it was doing. It was literally, I think benzo withdrawal is a soul sucker. I mean, it is just it's a hope thief. And, it was doing that. And I just thought, I have to do something. And so you're exactly right. You know, in the moments that I could write or record a video, sometimes I would find the symptoms didn't abate completely, but they would bind a little bit. Because I think I was remembering who I was. I wasn't just this lump in my room, you know, taking up space and being babysat. You know, and so The Waiting Room will be out in a couple of weeks, and it's in essence like kind of part memoir. Well, you know, it doesn't really fit in nicely into a category, which is a little problematic, but it definitely tells my story. And then what I did was I basically kind of use it as kind of a launching pad, a discussion about what I've learned that works and doesn't work. And what I did was I kind of went back through my 26 years of being a clinician and was like, okay, what did I used to work with on my clients that I could maybe apply to myself? And then I found things that worked and what didn't work. What was most fascinating to me in the process of writing the book and in doing just tons of research, you know, and I'll go into the benzo-induced OCD in a second, because that was a big part of it. But, you know, I had depersonalization, derealization. I had terrible. I have terrible chemical depression and anxiety. And I talk about that in the book and differentiate what that is. But I also decided to kind of focus on, okay, look, this is what we've got now. This is what I've got. This is the hand that I've been dealt. Now what? And that's the focus of the book. It's here's my story. This is the hand I've been dealt. This is the hand you've been dealt. Now what? May not be many things we can do to make it better. What can we do to not make it worse? But the first thing I had to really focus on for myself was I had to change everything I had learned about my about the mind. You know, I was trained psychoanalytically, you know, and even though I'm more eclectic in my approach now, what that means is that I had learned to take what somebody thinks and feels and give it such focus and primacy and let's analyze it, let's interpret it, let's assess it, right? Well, in benzo withdrawal, if you take that approach, you're going to go downhill really fast because the stuff, the feelings and thoughts that come through your mind when your limbic system is blown up the way ours is, are terrifying thoughts and feelings. And so what I had to first learn was how to have a different relationship with my mind. And I would say that's the probably what the book speaks to the most on a holistic level is a different, we have to have a different relationship with ourselves and our minds in order to survive benzo withdrawal. Because if we come from that place of I'm thinking it, therefore it must be true. I'm feeling it, therefore it must be true. I'm having this terrible sensation, feeling or thought, let me fight it. We actually make it worse. We actually dig the hole deeper. And, you know, we become quite anxious in this, and at least I did, and I know many people I speak to have. And if you think about like what anxiety, you know, what drills anxiety in people, it's feeling uncertain, it's feeling vulnerable, and it's feeling out of control. Well, there's nothing that I've experienced in my life besides benzo withdrawal that has made me feel more vulnerable, more out of control, and less certain. And so we're left with these very fragile states. And the premise of the book is to kind of offer hope and to offer different strategies and things that I kind of tried that worked or didn't work, and ways to think about ourselves in this. And really, you know, I pull that quote a lot that's attributed to Viktor Frankl, even though he actually never said it, but it's attributed to him, which is that space between the stimulus and response is the freedom to choose, is our choice. And in that is our freedom. And finding that space between, you know, oh my God, this terrifying thought, feeling, sensation in my body, and believing I have any choice in how I'm going to respond to that feels completely undoable in benzo withdrawal. You know, we just feel we're just getting, you know, it's like an onslaught, right? So it was a shift in mindset, as well as, you know, looking and coming up with different things that work and don't work, at least for right. me.
And then the YouTube channel I like because they can see you. And again, you give humor, you've done some research, you've given some great advice. So I encourage everybody to go to Jennifer Swan, PhD. This is a really fantastic channel that you've done here. I mean, you're just pouring all your suffering, all that you're learning into it, you know? So the other thing is you're now also on the advisory board of Benzodiazepine Information Coalition, which is BIC. Can you tell me if there are any specific goals that you're looking for, looking at as far as advocacy work that you're going to be doing, or you're just doing your thing, which is fantastic. You're doing multiple things.
Yeah. I was very blessed and feel very grateful to have been asked to be on that board and love what they're doing. Love some of the things they're coming out with, the bind, the benzo induced, neurological dysfunction term they're coining and writing about.
I like that.
Yeah. They're coming up with some great stuff. And, I just started with them. So I did one thing I did. As they're asking me to do things, I'm showing up and doing that. I'm working on a blog for BIC right now on benzo-induced OCD. And hopefully that'll get passed and that'll be posted on their website, I'm hoping. And then just kind of, you know, working with them as needed and on different projects. And so I'm just kind of getting my feet wet with them.
I have a really good question for you, because again, there's a lot going on. So you've got your book, you've got the YouTube channel, As Prescribed just had its world premiere on June 4th. There's so many things coming out that everybody who has been affected, they want to just give back and educate. But when you are recovered, do you feel that you've that what you've gone through has changed the course of your career? Because I know you're so multi-talented. Where do you think you'll go when you're recovered? I don't even know if you can predict, because I know we all have to protect ourselves as much as possible.
Well, yeah. I mean, the course of my career has already, shifted. Yeah. And it will continue to shift. I think I will go back and pick up a little bit of what I used to do, but I'll be honest, you know, what I really, when I sit and kind of dream about what I want is I envision some sort of central site. You know, I live in Texas, and so there's a lot of land kind of out near where I live. I live a little bit outside of Houston, and I envision having this kind of ranch type place that sits as like a hub of information and advocacy and support, and maybe offering respite services for people that need to maybe be away from their families for a couple months during some acute times, where they have some support and they have people that know what they're going through, but can also provide a lot of education and support for family members and family therapy for people that have children. I know you, when you were going through yours, your children were growing up, and I've met many people where that's the case. They're trying to parent through this, and you know, just having a place that either people can come and or people can call into and get good support. That's my goal, is to do a lot of family work as well as hopefully some open a place that offers some rest.
You are, I mean, in the midst of your suffering, you are giving back so much. I mean, you are amazing. So I want to thank you for being on today, and continue to do all the good work that you're doing.
Thanks, Geraldine. I really appreciate it.
All right, Garrett, we just finished a really good podcast with Jen. Quite interesting. She's very well educated. She's suffering, and she's also giving back at the same time, which is phenomenal. And I think through her suffering, there's going to be more education going on with her book and her YouTube channels. And
yeah, I mean, I think you kind of said it right there. You know, as I was listening to the interview as you were doing it, you know, just a few minutes ago, you hate to say it out loud, but it's like it almost takes people like Jen, you know, going through this experience to help in the advocacy, because, you know, where most of us are not trained in the medical profession, it's difficult to kind of articulate what's going on. Mm-hmm. She's able to do it very well. So it's helpful to have people like that are, you know, willing to share their stories.
Yeah. And her book, I mean, I did get to read it. It is phenomenal. And she has such a good sense of humor, you know, in the midst of her suffering, that she could write this. And she adds a little bit of humor. So you just really connect with her. You really do feel like you're sitting in a room with her, and you've got your own private clinical psychologist helping you through benzo withdrawal. And the fact that we're doing this podcast now before her book comes out, but while she's still in the midst of it. Because sometimes when you're years away, even like me, I forget something sometimes until I'm talking to somebody, and then it reminds me.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what you know, some of our podcasts are like post that book coming out, because I'm sure everybody that's in this community that's been reading the internet for a long time or listening to our podcast will want to read that book.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see what people think of it.
Yeah, fantastic interview. So we do encourage everybody, please go to her YouTube channel. Again, it's Jennifer Swan, PhD. And can we put that in the link for all of this?
Yeah, we'll put that in the link.
Yeah, in the link to her book. You know, I'm not sure how.
Which today is, we're recording on June 9th. So she said, beginning of July, hopefully the book will be available.
End of June, beginning of July.
The name of the book again?
It's called In the Waiting. It's called The Waiting Room. And let me just get the full name of it. Because then it has some, it's called The Waiting Room, My Journey of Recovery from Medication Injury and Benzodiazepine Withdrawal. It's going to be, I hope, as I said in the interview, I hope it's in every school. Everybody needs to read this. You shouldn't even be counseling people unless you understand what somebody might be going through. Because a lot of people all these years said, if I just had a counselor who understood, you know, what I'm going through, then get her book, go to her YouTube channel. Here's somebody that understands.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully we'll record another podcast before before it gets released, and we can remind everybody that it's released, you know, in a couple of days, whatever it is. And, you know, obviously we haven't been getting podcasts out as normal, well,
because
which you can explain where you've been for the past 4 months
or so. Yeah. So, our last podcast was end of January, and then my mother fell on February 17th
in Florida.
And for those that, you know, have listened to the podcast, my mother has polio in her right arm. She fell, broke her left arm and her left femur, which left my mother
full nightmare situation.
Yeah. Full nightmare situation. So she was in the hospital for 3 weeks. I was packed and ready to go that night, but they wouldn't let anybody in due to COVID, but finally allowed my sister, who was a nurse, to come in because she needs to be scratched, fed, everything. She could not function at all. And then I flew down, Dad and I flew down March 17th. And so things were hectic on the phone every day till I got there. And then when I arrived, she was in a rehab. And I literally was at the rehab every day. The few times, if anybody saw on Facebook that I'm out, well, those are the only times I had got somebody to come and take care of her while I went. Because at the same time, my sister had already prearranged to have her knee replaced. You know, she was having it replaced for a second time because, I don't know, we still think they put the wrong size knee in. So we decided to have my sister go ahead, have her knee replaced, because I would be with my mother every day and Dad would be there for Diana and take her to therapy. So we had a lot going on. So talk about stress. And so one of the things I do is I actually do take things that are all natural just to kind of protect my nervous system, because I would be at the rehab from sometimes 8 or 9 in the morning and I left at 8 o'clock every night. And it was so hard to leave my mother because in the first few weeks she needed so much care that when I left at night, you weren't sure if they were going to take care of her, because she couldn't use her hand, but we could put the call button in her hand. If she lost that, if it fell out of her hand, she couldn't get it. It was a lot. But then after a few weeks, by 7 weeks, almost 8 weeks, the cast came off and she could slowly start feeding herself. We didn't have to feed her anymore. And all the therapy in the world, you know, we don't believe she's ever going to walk again. So she's a full lift now. So I certainly got some toning in my arms, lifting her, taking her to the bathroom, getting her in and out of bed. So,
yeah.
but we flew home because Holly Hardman's documentary As Prescribed was coming out. And we did fly home for the premiere.
Yeah.
And we just all went to it, the whole family, Garrett and his fiance Mariah, and my daughter went, my nephew James went, and we went to the premiere, and I got to say, it is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It starts off with such an impact, that first few minutes, and it shows in the State House, and it shows the doctors, and the different people she's following, it shows their lives, and I think it's going to be a very, very powerful documentary. It shows everything that, you know, we went through over the years that she was filming, and she caught.
How did you feel seeing yourself on the big screen?
All I could look at, to be honest, was how crooked my teeth were thanks to benzos. And I had started Invisalign literally 2 days before my mother fell. Because for those that don't know, I actually did put braces on 6 years ago. And I was so careful about everything I did, but the doctor put nickel wires in my mouth and I was highly allergic, and 10 days later had them taken off. And it took me all this time to trust enough to do Invisalign, and already my front teeth are practically perfectly straight. So that's all I zeroed in at that. And I zeroed in on how much weight I put on over the years she was filming. So that's what I saw. And my hair, different colors, different styles.
Hair, yeah.
It's because if it was the summer, it got lighter or whatever.
I was noticing that in myself, different haircuts over the past couple of years.
Yeah, but Holly, I'll tell you, I don't know what the process is as far as, you know, it has to go to film festivals or whatever. This is going to be a very powerful documentary. Some of the people that got up when we were at the hearings in Boston testifying, still to this day, I cry every time I see Josh. You know, she got Josh with his brother. I cry even when I talk about it half the time. But even when the documentary first started, you go to cry listening to the first few minutes. And then, you know,
you know, I think, too, if you're listening to this and you do end up seeing As Prescribed, and we don't have a lot of information right now about where and when you can see it, right? Because it's still, they're going through the film
festivals.
It's a
whole process, right.
But with Josh, you'll get to see Josh and his brother testify. I would say if you're interested in his story, then go back and listen to our podcast after, because we have a pretty good one with him where he kind of tells his whole story But he's an interesting guy, and he's got an awesome company now.
Yeah, a couple of companies. He's actually started another company, and this is all due to he should never have been prescribed Ativan, and it just went in and kind of just ruined his gut and caused all kinds of injury and anxiety, just like we all get. And from his bed, he starts this company. He knows he has to make a living, and he's so ill he can't function. And just watching the two brothers as they're both up there crying is it's very emotional. I go to cry every look at it. I even want to cry now. So Holly really caught some fantastic footage that, I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah.
So well worth the wait, and we can't wait for everybody to see it. All right, so I think that's it. We're so grateful to Jen, and we wish her so much happiness and success with her book and with her YouTube channel, because those that have suffered are that when they come out of this and they start making a difference down the road, there just has to be some changes to understand, you know, pharmaceutical harm.
Oh, the other thing we can mention right now is the bill. The bill got out of committee in the time that you were gone. Just recently, actually, right
the day before the documentary's premiere. Yes. So explain that. So now that it's out of committee, what happened?
So you'll see in the documentary the bill being heard before a committee. The name of that committee is the Mental Health Substance Use and Recovery Committee.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the bill is always sent to that committee. We've had, we've had a different chair every time we filed it.
Yeah.
So somebody different hearing it that kind of controls the committee each time. So that's like the first big hurdle is, you know, getting a favorable report coming out of there. The bill had been extended. So
it was accepted once right before COVID hit, but then it got.
But then obviously we go through COVID and it's not a priority. But so in the legislature, we have something called Joint Rule 10, which requires us to have heard a bill and, you know, acted on it before a certain date in the calendar. We got to that Joint Rule 10 date. No news about the benzo bill. Turns out they extended it, and then I believe they extended it a second time as well. So it seemed like, oh boy, they got to send it three times.
Was it a third time? I don't know.
Either way, it kept getting extended and extended, and so anytime you kind of see that, you'd go, well, they're either working on it or they just haven't had time to get to it. And if they don't have time to get to it, you know, the schedule of the legislature continues to move on, and the bill could end up dying. So with this one, you know, almost right before we left for the Berkshires to go to, is it called the Berkshire International Film Festival?
Yep.
We got news from the clerk's office that the bill got reported out favorably with changes. I haven't been able to, like, fully look at the changes yet. They're, like, in our internal system. But
one of the changes we want, because it got dropped accidentally, is that long-term uses are to be protected. It doesn't show in the bill if somebody goes to look at it. No long-term user should be forced off. And we see that happening all the time. Doctors just like, nope, cutting them off. You can't have that.
And it's something that we can work on as it continues through the process. But, you know, major hurdle, we're through that committee. More than likely it moves on to healthcare financing now. Hopefully get it through there quickly and then to Ways and Means.
How soon do you think it could be? When I was speaking to your Jody, your chief of staff, she said something about July. If I remember right, what happens then? We have to...
So the end July 31st is the last day in the legislative session.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it essentially would be dead then, July 31st.
So is there anything any of us here in Massachusetts can do? Yeah. Or it's out of our hands at this point and it's in up to our representatives and senators?
Yeah, if you are in Massachusetts listening to this, call your local rep, your local senator. Ask them to support the bill. If they can give a call to healthcare financing to give it a favorable report and move it out. The bill is really not a money bill. There's not really a cost associated with it, so I don't think that committee should spend much time with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the problem with them is they have a lot of bills in their committee. A lot of stuff goes through them, so it may be a time issue, but we'll work on that.
Okay. All right. Well, another great podcast, and hopefully now that I'm home, I don't know how long I'm home for. I might have to go back to Florida again, so we're going to try to get a few out while I am here. And then once I leave, you know, it'll be on pause again.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate everybody looking, really watching these, listening all the time, and watch for more. We're going to try to get them out. Thank you.